finish the healthcare division, and then we'll be moving on to some of the boards and to the veterans' nursing homes. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare, Minnesota Department of Human Services. If you look at your index that we provided, we should be in the eligibility categories in terms of change pages. Start on page 97, I believe. And also, Madam Chair, members, I'm going to reference times page 17 in your green section in the back of your book. That's where our eligibility graph is. It tells eligibility standards for our current programs. So that's something that you're going to want to reference periodically here as I go through these pages. On page 97, this proposal would eliminate eligibility of MinnesotaCare GAMC hospital only and MinnesotaCare for adults without children. The proposal would eliminate GAMC hospital only program effective January 2010, eliminate transitional MinnesotaCare effective January 2010, effective January 2010, maintain GAMC at current income and asset limits for applicants and enrollees who have the qualifiers described in current law. Those qualifiers are detailed in this budget page. This proposal would eliminate MinnesotaCare eligibility for adults without children effective January 2010. This is projected to impact 55,000 people now enrolled in our programs. An additional 10,000 adults without kids would be affected in large part because the expansion of coverage to 250% of FPG for adults without kids would not go into effect until July of this year, and under this proposal will not go into effect. So there is 55,000 roughly adults without children currently enrolled are affected, an additional 10,000 that would be enrolled as of July of next year. This proposal represents a reduction in healthcare access fund and general fund spending of $508 million for the 10-11 biennium.
Just so we can be clear, Assistant Commissioner, today people go into the GAMC program if they have roughly under $9,000 a year income and have no health care insurance. And if they don't meet one of these categories, being homeless or one of these other categories, then they go in to transitional MinnesotaCare. So they're on the GAMC program for about 4 months, 3 months. They would be eliminated under this proposal also.
Madam Chair, that is correct. If you look at page 17, again, that graph, the best way, you should have a second graph too, but if you look at the graph on page 17, there's four green boxes in the middle, adults without children. What would be remaining is GAMC for 75% and under. The other three boxes would be eliminated. Remember, GHO is just a episodic payment arrangement for adults without kids between 75 and 175% of poverty.
Are there any other questions about this page?
Madam Chair, I'd like to then bring up to page 111. This proposal would eliminate additional 2 months of MA coverage and automatic MinnesotaCare coverage for children who are ineligible for medical assistance because of excess family income. The most recent MinnesotaCare waiver extension was submitted in December 2007 and approved October 2008. The waiver is currently approved through June 2011. During the waiver renewal process, CMS denied Minnesota's request to include this initiative, which was enacted in 2007. That would provide additional 2 months of MA coverage and automatic MinnesotaCare coverage for kids who are ineligible for MA because of excess family income. CMS indicated that DHS could resubmit this waiver request outside of the full waiver renewal process, but they did challenge the fact that they didn't, the budget neutrality requirement would be a difficult one to meet, but we still have, they did not close the door entirely on the notion of coming back at some point with a request. And as you pointed out, Madam Chair, some legislation currently pending does direct us to do that.
And of course, Assistant Commissioner, these children are eligible.
Madam Chair, that's correct. They're eligible for medical, for Minnesota care.
Right.
That's right. So it's not an eligibility effect, it's an enrollment effect. And that's a kind of distinction we need to make here at times. That's true.
And so, you know, getting medical assistance match for them through Minnesota care shouldn't be that hard.
Madam Chair, no, we will have, as you know, we will have, we'll tap out our SCHIP money. We'll make sure we maximize that. Then anything above that in terms of covering kids, we have medical assistance match, 50% match. So we will continue to have that. But SCHIP now covers kids between over 150% in Minnesota care. And SCHIP is 65% federal match. The new SCHIP legislation allows us to cover kids between 133 and 150% of FPG. If we come then of course we have the option to go beyond 275 if we come up with a state match. So, but we'll maximize our SCHIP allotment, and then.
So, Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner, why is this a budget neutrality issue?
It is. I don't know the details.
These children are eligible, right?
Yes, that's not the question.
As far as I can tell, I don't even understand why we need to ask for a waiver.
Well, Madam Chair, that is clear. The different way of going about this would increase MA standard, make it cleaner to go up to 170. That's one thing we need. If the legislature is interested in pursuing further other changes that simplify this, that may be the one way to go about doing this is increasing the MA standard instead of having this arrangement. Obviously, as we know, the arrangement here was tried to maximize the availability of the health care access fund and to move kids over to Minnesota care, and thus instead of increasing the MA standard. I think there's different ways of going about it. It's probably what CMS is telling us at this point.
But under the governor's proposal, these children are just eliminated.
These children are not eliminated in terms of eligibility, as you pointed out. They are.
But the idea was to make them automatically move right from one program to another so they don't lose
right
their eligibility and parents don't have to go through the hassle of renewing an application when we know they're eligible.
Madam Chair, that's true. Because of the process and the premiums they'll be then paid, there would be a fall-off effect. And that's what this projection reflects, is how many children would not be covered in Minnesota care because of this program not being in effect. It's an enrollment effect because of what you just said, the process and perhaps the premiums.
Are there any other questions about this page? All right, let's go on then.
On page 106, this proposal would eliminate scheduled Minnesota care premium reductions. This proposal would eliminate the premium reductions of 0.5% of household income for enrollees with income above 100% and 1% of household income for enrollees with income above 200%. And the new affordability scale that was part of the health care reform legislation last year, which was scheduled to go into effect July of this year. Elimination, the 0.5 and the 1% increase is scheduled to go into effect this spring. And as I said, the affordability scale, which brings it down to 8% of household income in terms of the cap around Minnesota care premiums, would go into effect July 1st of this year. This proposal reduces state health care access fund spending by $6.4 million for the 10-11 biennium. This will reduce projected Minnesota care enrollment of parents and children by 1,900 individuals. So it does not affect current enrollment, but affects, because those premium reductions have not gone into effect yet. So the fact that it's not going to go into effect under this proposal, there will be 1,900 less people enrolled in the program.
Assistant Commissioner, we've noticed that most everything that we agreed to last year has been eliminated in the governor's budget except for the $12 million that the Department of Health got.
Madam Chair, all of the health care reform pieces in terms of health care home and all the Article 4 pieces are still in play. I think what has been affected, of course, is the expansion for coverage as well as the impact on the state health improvement program. Those are the two. But everything else in terms of funding, the ongoing funding of the health care reform articles.
Right. The $12 million we gave the Department of Health is not eliminating the governor's budget, but everything else that we did is.
Madam Chair, on the accessibility side, the expansion of coverage side, that is correct.
So you can imagine we're really excited about that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Was the $12 million, wasn't that tied to some of those health care initiatives? I mean, was it?
They were administrative dollars. They were given to the Department of Health over a four-year period to administer various parts of the reform effort.
That's what I thought.
There were many other important parts of the reform as well, including reducing premiums to make the program more affordable.
So, Madam Chair, why would the health department need the $12 million? Or I guess is that your point?
No, my point is that there were a lot of important things in that reform effort, and they've pretty much all been repealed in the governor's budget except for that piece. If we want them to do the rest of the reform, they still would need the money, but it was a package at the time, and the package is kind of, one side of the package has kind of been lopped off here. Other questions? Go on then.
Madam Chair, members, page 109. This proposal would increase the minimum base premium for medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, enrollees, from $35 to $50 per month and increase the unearned income obligation from 0.5% to 2.5% of unearned income per month, effective January 2010. Over 98% of our MAEPD enrollees also receive Social Security disability income. These SSDI payments are indexed each year. SSDI recipients receive an annual COLA as well, which since 2004 has ranged from 2.7% to 5.8%. It's our estimate that this will not affect enrollment, that 7,200 individuals are on our MAEPD program, and that this premium increase will not reduce that projected enrollment. This saves about $1.6 million in general fund savings.
So are the savings from increased revenues? And if they are, why is this listed as expenditure?
So is the money that's being shown saved on this page just from the increased premiums?
Madam Chair, it's from the increased premiums and the increased in the unearned income. Obligation as well.
You just said nobody was going to be going off the program due to the changes in this budget page, so.
Well, that's, again, Madam Chair, that's why I pointed out that the SSDI payments and annual COLA are going up. So we think that they'll be able to afford this increase, and thus the program is beneficial enough that they will stay on it. They will not drop off. That's our
Assistant question. Commissioner, we're having trouble understanding this page because if this is coming from increased premiums, then the funding should show up under revenues, not expenditures.
Madam Chair, I will defer to our fiscal staff on that. It seems reasonable to me. Yeah. All right.
So it's an error in the formatting of the page.
Apologize. We will we'll correct it.
There are other questions on this page? Go on then.
Madam Chair, members, page 107. This proposal would repeal the Minnesota Care Premium Grace Month and Minnesota Care eligibility for additional or rolling month for enrollees who failed to submit renewal forms. This proposal is effective July 2009. These proposals have not yet been implemented, so they would not impact current enrollees. It will reduce projected Minnesota Care enrollment by approximately 3,100 for the 10-11 biennium. Let me point out, however, that the current Minnesota Care statute allows for a reinstatement process for enrollees who fail to pay their premiums. Persons disenrolled for failure to pay premiums who paid the past due premium as well as the current premium due within 20 months of disenrollment are re-enrolled retroactively and maintain coverage without a lapse. So there's still a process for people to make sure that they stay on even though they fail to make a payment on a timely basis. This reduces healthcare access fund expenditures by $6.8 million for the biennium.
And Assistant Commissioner, would this recommendation be made if the recommendation to roll the healthcare access fund into the general fund were not part of the budget?
Madam Chair, yes, it would.
Because?
Because of savings associated with it.
But if the money stayed in the health care access fund, what would the savings be for?
Madam Chair, if our budget solution did not include the health care access fund, that's true. That does include the health care access
fund. So if we were not rolling the health care access fund into the general fund, would you still be making this recommendation?
Madam Chair, I probably would be making the recommendation on one of these two, perhaps, because inconsistent, number one, both the rolling month and the grace period, because one, you pay the additional month, and the other, you don't. And so it's inconsistent. We weren't sure how we're going to administer this anyway, to be honest with you. Plus, as I said, we have a reinstatement process already in current law. As I'm thinking about it, this would be a very, very maintaining this would be a low priority. We would make a change here. What exactly it would be, I would have to go back and let you know. But if it wasn't for financial savings, we'd still be making a change, but I would have to tell you, come back and tell you exactly what that would be, because I want to make sure that it works well with the current law of reinstatement of coverage.
Well, Assistant Commissioner, it seems to me that really the goal of this page is to generate savings. The way you generate savings is by having fewer people enrolled.
But Madam Chair, again, it's not an eligibility impact. It's an enrollment impact. And the primary reason, it is for savings, is the primary reason. But I think if we kept these, I still think we need to talk to the committee about how this would work, because they are inconsistent. These two, this rolling eligibility and the grace period are inconsistent. So we need to talk about how we should fix this. If we don't do this, we don't need to do this for financial reasons. We need to do it for administrative reasons, if nothing else.
Assistant Commissioner Osberg, isn't it true this page almost entirely affects enrollment of children?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that would be the case.
According to the sheet you gave us that shows the enrollment effects, that's what it says.
Madam Chair, it does over time because only children are in the health care access or Minnesota care over time. If you look at near term, the impact is parents and kids in terms of 2010 effect. The only reason that there is an effect over time on kids is because there's only children in our set of proposals, there's only children left in Minnesota care.
Are there other questions about this page, Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we even started on this page, I was looking at it, and I was thinking this needs a lot of work. This is an area that we should really take a look at, because even with the savings, as you, I would agree with you, even with these savings, this is an area that is problematic.
Problematic for what reason?
Well, it isn't consistent, but I think this is an area that what we were trying to get to last year with this proposal is something that we should still push forward.
You know, this is really just treating Minnesota Care like other insurance. You get a grace month in regular insurance to catch up on your payments if you don't get it in quite in time.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, you don't have though a grace month and a rolling month. That's not
well. Of course, we were. The goal of this was to try to get closer to achieving universal coverage.
Madam Chair, if that's the context, then right, we should approach this differently.
Well, I think that's the point. The administration never understood that that was part of the health care reform last year.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I think the administration understood that that was an objective over time, but that was not going to be accomplished based on what was enacted last year. And now the question is whether or not the state can, over time, do this without federal assistance.
Other questions about this page? Let's move on then.
On page 99, going back to page 99, Madam Chair. This proposal would eliminate eligibility for Minnesota Care for parents and caretakers. Parents of children under age 19 with incomes at or below 100% of the federal poverty guideline would qualify for MA, or MA with a spend down. If you look at that graph, again, on page 17, you can see where medical assistance for parents below 100% is maintained. This would be effective July 2010 or upon federal approval, whichever is later. This is projected to impact approximately 29,000 parents now enrolled. MA average enrollment would increase by 9,000 by the end of the biennium due to the parents moving over. Parents that are now in Minnesota Care moving over to medical assistance. There would be 6,800 fewer children enrolled in Minnesota Care because of the fact that parents are not covered. There's an impact on children. Parents then, for various reasons, do not then enroll their kids even though they're eligible. So this 6,800 children are eligible, but they're not enrolled because of the fact that the parents are not eligible. And that is part of the impact on your enrollment page.
Any questions about this page? Let's move on then.
Last page, Madam Chair, is page 134, all the way back. This proposal would repeal current law that requires DHS to mail an additional renewal notice reminder to enrollees both 90 and 60 days prior to the renewal date, and managed care plans are mandated to place a follow-up renewal call at least 60 days prior to the enrollee's renewal date. The notices and these phone calls from the health plans have created anxiety and confusion for clients. In some cases, clients have submitted renewal forms much too early with information that is not timely enough for a worker to process the renewal. It was a good effort to try to make sure that people who are up for renewal are aware of it, but it just simply did not work as the way we were hoping it would. And there's small savings associated with this.
Are there any questions about this page? I guess not. Any other questions for the Assistant Commissioner? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Next, we have the Nursing Home Administrators Board and the Administrative Service Unit, Randy Snyder and Julie Bagnus.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Randy Snyder. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing Home Administrators, which is also the lead agency for the Administrative Services Unit, and we are seeking three change items today that were included in the governor's budget. With me is Julie Bagsness. She's the lead staff member for ASU and accounting supervisor by position title. She also manages the voluntary health care provider program that is currently provided for this state. Our time today was to include a very quick overview of Minnesota occupational licensing, which I'll do, followed by the six boards that are actually looking at change items in great respect to your time. Minnesota has 15 health licensing boards. That's fewer than most states. The two largest boards that you hear of are typically the Board of Medical Practice with over 22,000 licensed physicians and other licensees, and 104,000 nurses are regulated in their individual practice by the Board of Nursing. The health licensing boards were created as 15 independent state agencies. So the boards were to be directed by citizens. We average anywhere from 7 to 20 citizens that are directing our daily operations and our rules. There's a blend of both public and licensed professionals that serve on those boards. Everyone has different requirements as to that. Some boards require more public members than the professional members to serve. Funding for all the boards is placed in the special revenue fund. They're financed exclusively by fees that we generate. We have to come before you as the legislature then and the governor's budget to seek permission to set those fees and then to seek authority to spend those fees. There are no general fund dollars associated with health licensing boards. ASU also does provide support, though, for two general funded boards, and those are the boards of Barber and Cosmetology and the Emergency Medical Regulatory Services Board. We're all co-located together. A quick summary of ASU in 1993, the health licensing boards saw that it was wiser to collaborate and to look at our back office, our common business functions, and therefore we created this unit we call ASU or Administrative Services. We long believed in the centralized division to have accounting, finance, accounts payable, payroll, all those things. Contracts, purchasing, and IT were better served when we collaborated together. There are six individuals with expertise to serve for all of those boards. We understand it's a model that does work, quite frankly. So we need good news sometimes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and this is a model that does work very well. We understand MMB has also put together a group called SMART for other boards and agencies. And in the spirit of cooperation, if there were other like small boards or agencies that needed the support of our unit, we'd be open to that as well. One other fact that we are very proud of in health licensing is our current electronic government services that all boards offer online services now, including most online renewals. Since 1999, we have been leveraging all of our financial resources, and we have approximately 80 to 90% of our licensees renewing online now. That is probably going to be your ceiling, Madam Chair, as there are many individuals that prefer to have that paper model and stay out of cyberspace. So we have put together a very effectively electronic government system for licensing, sharing those services again. And this is all done. Overall, our fees for the majority of Minnesota licensees are at the 50th percentile or less. So we have done this as efficiently as we can. For example, a nurse in Minnesota pays approximately $10 less than their national counterpart. So, again, we have to tell you when some things do work. With that quick summary, Madam Chair, we will have ASU present their change items. The Board of Nursing is seeking a very similar change item, and they will come before you. There are two boards, the Board of Chiropractic and Veterinarian Medicine, that are seeking fee increases, and two boards, the Dietetics and Social Work, Board of Social Work, are seeking fee decreases. I should mention the other boards not here or not included in the governor's change item request. They are included in ASU or included with us. Medical practice, the Board of Dentistry, Optometry, Behavioral Health and Therapy, Marriage and Family Therapy, Pharmacy, Physical Therapy, Podiatry, and Psychology. Some of those directors are in the audience today, and I can either be a messenger if you have concerns for them, or you can direct a question towards them. And before we get to the actual change items, are there just any questions on the general overview? If not, we'll proceed to the change items.
Any questions so far? Okay, let's go on then.
My name is Julie Vangsis, and I'm with the Administrative Services Unit. And I'm not sure what page in your book, but under the Nursing Home Administrative Board on page, like, 7 is our first change request.
Right. It's in the section that we have tabs for each of these. So it's in the section under Nursing Home Administrators Board.
Our first request is to cover retirement costs. We are asking for a one-time appropriation of $201,000 to be appropriated in 2010 to cover 9 anticipated retirements of long-term and state employees that are located within 7 of the health licensing boards. The funds will cover their severance and their vacation payouts, and in most cases, these funds will then, and they don't go directly to the employee, they go to their health care savings account. The Administrative Services Unit will transfer the funds as the retirements come up within those boards directly to the board. Any questions on that one?
Any questions?
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the board members are being paid a retirement? Is that, or am I misunderstanding?
Well, they get retirement out of the retirement fund. This is their severance package if they have unpaid vacation or unpaid sick leave. That's paid out in a lump sum to them at the time they retire.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, these are staff members that are retiring. It used to be the individual boards would come before you 9 different times, and what they did this year is they lumped them all into ASU to pay them out. That's essentially it. It's more or less like an accounting shift, Madam Chair, Senator Olson. It's staff members.
Any other questions? Let's go on then.
Our second proposal is on page 8. It's for a legal analyst position. We are asking for a permanent base increase. We're asking for $85,000 in fiscal year 10 and $87,000 in fiscal year 11 to cover this new position within ASU. This position will provide legal drafting assistance to the boards. Currently, we've received these services from the Attorney General's office, but due to their decrease and the number of paralegals available to us, we have determined that our best option is then to bring on this staff member within our health, within the Administrative Services Unit, to provide these services to all of the boards. We consider this somewhat of an accounting shift that we currently would be paying the Attorney General's office for, and now would request the funds directly appropriated to us to hire this position. Any questions on that proposal?
So is there a reduction somewhere else then in your budget that would show less money being transferred to the Attorney General's office?
Madam Chair, currently the Attorney General's office gets a direct appropriation out of the Special Revenue Fund, and we don't pay directly for those services, even though the boards have revenue support all of the expenditures. And
so this would show up in the Attorney General's budget.
And it's really not going to be.
Which is not in this division.
Right. And it's not really going to be in a reduction to them just because of the need for Attorney General cost in other areas. So we're still going to be using the Attorney General's office for attorney support, and we're not really cutting back. We're actually increasing that need also.
So it's not a shift then?
Our increase is lower than what it would be if they still provided the service to us. So instead of paying them $110,000 for the service, because they no longer have paralegals, we would have to pay attorneys to do this work, and the backlog would probably just grow. We are proposing then to hire this individual within the Administrative Services Unit at a lower rate. We still will be paying the Attorney General's probably as much as we paid in the prior years for the services that we received.
And what would the services be that you would be receiving from the Attorney General's office, since you would not be using this service any from them any longer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this actually came up from the Attorney General's office for us to look at. They no longer have paralegals that are willing to do this work. They came to us and said it would probably be wiser for you to hire your own staff at the paralegal level, this legal analyst. So you are correct. There is no accounting shift. We're asking for increase in dollars, and I can't speak for the AG's office how they're handling their budget. For us, it's a matter of essence to get this, to get the work done. Our backlog is growing in the number of cases that we have. To expedite those cases, we would rather pay our own legal analyst this $85,000 per year than to being billed at $115 for the Attorney General. That work will be done by the attorneys rather than this paralegal. So I can't speak for the Attorney General's office. This was a solution to save overall money, but I can't control that other side of the budget.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out where you're saving it. This page looks like we're spending it.
Madam Chair, you
so
are.
So I'm looking for where does the savings show up?
Madam Chair, you are increasing spending. The Attorney General's office is decreasing, and we will slow down the process. That's what will happen if we don't get this position funded. Costs will go up through the Attorney General because the attorneys will actually prepare this at $115 per billable hour rather than the paralegal position, what we're looking at.
Are there any other questions about this page? Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Did I hear you say that you'll be continuing to pay for other services at the Attorney General's office, and therefore your costs to the Attorney General will not go down? And if so, what are those services?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, all services, all legal services must be represented through the Attorney General's office. And we've seen our cases grow in complexity and both in the numbers of cases as well. Last year we had 3,291 cases against individual practices. So we have expanded the number of cases. They're taking longer to actually process. We don't anticipate that any board will see less legal fees paid to the actual attorneys, but this is meant to support the preparation of legal documents through this paralegal. Did I answer that, Senator Sharon?
So this is coming out of the surplus in the special revenue account for all the boards. And what is that surplus, do you know?
Right now it's approximately $12 million in the surplus.
Any other questions? Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, what other areas does this special revenue fund serve for that $12 million? Does anyone know?
Currently, all of the boards, as they collect revenues throughout the year, the money is deposited into the special revenue fund, and then we're appropriated funds out of that special revenue fund to operate. And due to budget cuts over the last several bienniums or changes in numbers of people registering or licensing under the boards has grown, the special revenue fund has also grown their fund balance. Anytime the boards do not spend their full appropriation, those monies also get canceled back down to that revenue fund. And we somewhat have a running balance of what each board's portion of that fund is.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
I also might mention that those revenues are the licensing fees for the various professions, whether it's nursing or psychologists or physical therapists or whatever. And those licensing fees have also been going up over the years. And that is because of the increase in investigations and in more complex cases. But it's very discouraging also to the licensees when those funds get raided and then their fees get increased again.
Madam Chair, okay, clarify. Also, Senator Rosen, we have been somewhat put on a budget as have all the state government, but our fees have been set. Our spending authority has been kept lower, and that almost creates this bigger pool of money. So it is a larger number than we wish. We think licensees would like to see a refund or used in health licensing if there's any way to do that. You have two boards that are seeking those fee decreases today.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, and I would just suggest another area for consideration in terms of a use for those fees, and that's the fact that when you have a board taking action with regard to someone's license, unlike the criminal court system where you don't have to pay the cost of prosecution, boards are requiring the licensee to have to pay to basically go through the process, not only their own legal costs, but the board's legal costs, which is, you know, sometimes just as expensive or more expensive than if you were going through the criminal court system, with just as much at stake for that person. So from a legal standpoint, I was wanting to try to eliminate the board's practice of doing that, but I didn't think that there was going to be money in the budget to do something like that this year. But if there's $20 million sitting in reserve, that might want to be considered as, you know, a place to think about. Or $12 million, I guess.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, and I'm not involved in that particular case, but there's a maximum, the civil monetary penalty amount of $10,000 that we can bail out. And those are really saved just for the most egregious cases. That's not a common practice, but you can deal with that board if you'd like to take that up.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would just say for the record that I would beg to differ with you there. You know, I guess I've got a constituent in my area who has billed, showed me bills for more than that, and, you know, his fellow professionals would not consider it to have been at all an egregious case. So that's, I guess we don't need to debate that here. But
any other questions about this request? Let's move on then.
Our final request is to increase the base budget of the Volunteer Healthcare Provider Program. This program purchases...
And you're on page...
Sorry about that. Page 10.
Okay.
This program purchases malpractice insurance for doctors, nurses, and dentists who provide volunteer services in the community. We currently have about 15 nonprofit organizations or clinics registered in the program and about 28 active volunteers. This program started in 2003 and has continued to grow each year. Our current base budget is $65,000, and we are asking for an increase of $14,000 in fiscal year 10 and $24,000 in fiscal year 11. The Administrative Services Unit receives no additional funds to operate this program, and 100% of the appropriation is used to practice the malpractice insurance. This program is funded through receipts collected through the Board of Medical Practice, Nursing, and Dentistry, and that they are allocated their costs based on the number of professions in the program. Currently, those three boards collect sufficient revenue to cover the cost of this proposal. Any questions?
Any questions about this page? Okay, let's move on.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we moving on past the nursing home administrators? Because I do have a couple questions.
This would be a good time to ask them then.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, Mr. Snyder, is it says here in the description is to provide global administrative tasks focusing on cooperative ventures. As a board, have you talked about how to, are you getting your nursing home administrators together to deal with the health insurance or the health benefits situation at nursing homes? Either in joint buying of an insurance policy, are you having those discussions? Because there are several truly severe, high-profile issues out in nursing homes right now, and one of them is they are eliminating their health care benefits to their workers just so they can meet the bottom line. So is this something that you're addressing as far as your board, what we can do to alleviate this problem to provide health insurance?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, actually I think the comments you're looking at were for the Administrative Services Unit. But you are right. Your assessment is correct on what is going on in long-term care right now and the inability to have health insurance for many, especially rural communities. They face that challenge. There are a number of areas that we are just participants with, providers and DHS looking at those areas of group health insurance. If
there is a study that we asked for last session.
Right, that's right.
It's not going to be done when we had hoped it would be done, but it will be done this summer.
And we have been partners with that, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, but that study should be completed soon.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. And then I also do want to challenge again the board to, are you looking at that requirement for nursing homes to have an RN to do all the paperwork? I know that is a federally mandated requirement, but it's something that is extremely egregious out in rural nursing homes when they are having a hard time finding RNs, number one, and then they have to keep them at the desk to do all the paperwork, and they aren't out there working with the patients. And I've had several calls from nursing home administrators just about in tears because they cannot fill that requirement. Are you, as a board, looking at that, and what are you doing with that on the federal side?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, again, very good assessment on your behalf. There is a shortage of RNs, and it's a challenge out there, especially rural facilities. That is actually a Department of Health issue. The Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services have that requirement. We would look at other options, though, for that. If we could offer our support and to be at any meetings with the Department of Health, they are the regulator in charge of that actual specific CMS requirement. So I'm not really answering your question other than we do support other models if that was ever available out there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Well, Mr. Stern, that is my question. Yep. Is there negotiations? Is there talks? Is there collaboration at all right now? Because all I'm hearing is that you would support it, but are we moving in that direction? That's what I want to know.
And Senator Berglund, or Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, that is a Minnesota Department of Health issue.
I think what he's telling you is that they don't regulate the nursing homes in this regard. They just license the administrators. So he suggests you direct your question to someone in the Department of Health, Mike Triple, maybe. Other questions? Okay, then let's move on. Welcome.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Renee Cronquist, and I am an assistant director at the Minnesota Board of Nursing. Our executive director, Shirley Brecken, would normally be the individual to address you, but she regrets she is unable to attend this morning. As you know, the Board of Nursing regulates nearly 104,000 registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, and advanced practice registered nurses. This is an increase of approximately 20% over the last two biennia. This is largely due to an increase in graduates from Minnesota nursing education programs. In addition to licensure, the board approves nursing education programs. The board has approved 11 new programs in the previous two biennia, which is an increase in 21%. And it really represents quite a significant change in that in the previous 10 years, there had not been any applications for new nursing programs. And with the recently approved programs, there are now 65 nursing education programs in the state of Minnesota. But even with that significant increase in nursing education programs, that we do anticipate that the shortage of nurses will continue and very likely worsen with the aging general population, which presents an increased demand for health care and nursing services. We also know, of course, that the nursing population itself is aging. Of the nurses currently licensed in Minnesota, nearly 55% of them will be over age 55 by just 2015. The governor's recommendation for the budget for FY 2010 is $3,321,000, and in 2011, $3,323,000. The board is committed to working and operating as efficiently as possible. As Mr. Snyder indicated, a couple of statistics, the Minnesota Board of Nursing's cost per licensee is actually $13 less than the national average of other boards of nursing. One of the ways that the board has, a really significant way we've been able to accomplish this is through the electronic services, which includes initial licensure, licensure renewal, and verification. Over 90% of licensure activities are transacted online. Finally, to address the change item that the governor has put forward, the board is also requesting a legal analyst position, $71,000 in the first year of the biennial and $73,000 in the second, for the purpose of drafting legal documents necessary to resolve open cases. In my day-to-day job, I'm responsible for overseeing the discipline process, so I can definitely attest to you that this is a needed position. Complaints regarding nursing practice have increased 28% since 2002. As was talked about earlier, the board receives its legal services from the Office of Attorney General, and those legal services have in the past included legal assistant, attorney, and investigator. As was indicated earlier, the legal assistant or paralegal position has essentially been eliminated at the AG's office. So the boards are needing to accomplish those activities elsewhere. At this time, the Board of Nursing has over 600 open complaints, with about 100 of them waiting for legal documents to be drafted. We believe that adding this position will decrease the amount of time to resolve discipline cases and increase public safety. There's also, we think, greater efficiency with having in-house drafting and being able to consult in real time with the staff assigned to cases and collaborate. And that addresses the change item. And I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee members may have.
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I was just wondering how many other legal analyst positions we'll be looking at today.
I don't know. I think the best thing is if we just continue, we'll find out.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, in that regard, I guess I'm just wondering, and maybe I'm misunderstanding this, if the licensing fees are paying for the cost of the licensing process, then why would that be an increase, general fund increase recommendation?
It's not. It's under. It's an increase under the revenue fund.
Oh, okay. So it would be coming from those licenses then.
Right. Uh-huh. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
This is a similar request, mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there is a set of dollars, if I understand this correctly, that comes from. All of the licensing fees that are set aside in a reserve, and each of the various boards are coming forward with a similar request, why wouldn't we coalesce this to a single kind of position to meet these objectives for all of the boards rather than each one making its own individual
request?
Well,
I think the last request was that for the boards that are grouped together. The nursing board is large enough that it's separate from those. Because of the large number of licensed nurses. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Let's move on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Dr. Larry Spicer. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, and I'm in my 17th year as the Executive Director for the Board. During that period of time, we have tried to use as many creative management possibilities as we can to try to maintain costs, and over the many years, we've actually been very successful in doing that. Some of them have been more creative than others. For example, the Board of Chiropractic, you've heard today that all the boards are allowing for online licensing renewal. The Board of Chiropractic was actually the second agency in the state of Minnesota to allow for that after the Department of Public Safety with driver's license renewals. As has been pointed out by my other colleagues here today, the board receives no general revenue fund dollars. We're all special revenue fund dollars. And I would like to sort of just quickly state here that in general, all these boards have two primary functions. I mean, most of what they do can be boiled down into those two primary functions, and that is licensure. In other words, we license practitioners that are entering the field for the purposes of providing services to the public. And the second thing that we do is we enforce the laws, and we do that through a number of various methods. The most extreme of those would be some form of discipline to the licensee. But we certainly engage in many other things. And I would say that anything that reduces or impacts the board's ability to use their received revenues is going to have some kind of an impact on one of those two functions. As an old physics professor of mine used to say, we eventually run up against the limitations of matter. If we only have so much money, there are only so many services that we can provide. And it really comes down to that. Now, as my colleagues have also pointed out to you, most of the other costs that we deal with are and have been going up for many years. For example, the Attorney General's costs, the contractual salary costs, rents, and all other ancillary costs that we deal with have been going up. And yet I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that in my experience from
Dr.
my board.
Dr. Spicer, if you could get to the point of the budget page, because we have only 15 minutes left this morning. The session starts at 10, and we have a number of other presentations.
Yes, Madam Chair. We are asking for the change items here primarily because we have been affected by two major items going on in the last few years, and that is that, one, the transfer of funds out of the general revenue fund, as was mentioned, out of the special revenue fund into the general revenue fund, that severely impacted our board's budget. In addition to that, for the last few years, there has been an inexplicable increase in the number of contested case hearings and in the intensity of the types of cases that the Board of Chiropractic is dealing with and has been dealing with. So for that reason, we've been finding ourselves actually moving into deficit spending, and that's the reason that we're asking for the change items here today. Beyond that, I really don't have much more to add. That really was taken to the end of my testimony, so I would be glad to stand for any questions that the committee may have.
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair. Dr. King, what are your fees per year for a chiropractor?
There, if you want to look on page 7, 6, no, page
I'm
7
sorry.
And page 8. The only question I have is you're raising chiropractor inactive license renewal fees. I'm not sure. You're not raising. Well, I guess you're raising them all.
Raising most of them,
keep picture inactive.
I believe. These fees, and just for the members of the committee, I would point out, as I said earlier, I've been with the board in my 17th year. These fees have never been raised in my entire tenure with the board. This would be the first raise in that period of time.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. John King. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine, and I will jump right to the point as instructed. The Board of Veterinary Medicine had two budget change items. One was included in the governor's budget, and that was to increase fees. Last time fees were increased to veterinarians was in 1997, over 13 years ago, if this should go into effect. There are four things that contributed: the need to increase fees. There were two unanticipated and unbudgeted contested cases. Second was the board's requirement to defend in court a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the laws that govern veterinary medicine. And the fourth thing was two of the last three bienniums, the legislature has transferred over $110,000 from the veterinary medical board portion of the Special Revenue Fund to help shore up the General Revenue Fund. The need to increase fees is so we can do our job and eliminate the special fund deficit that's allotted to the Board of Veterinary Medicine. And we're required by law to neither over-recover or under-recover, and that is the NIDAS for this fee increase requirement. I'd be happy to answer any questions, should there be any.
Just one clarification, and that is that there's an amount that's been allocated to each board out of the special revenue account, and so the transfers out of the special revenue account have nothing to do with the amount that you're allocated. And the fact that we have a very large amount in the special revenue account attests to that.
Madam Chair, you are correct. The monies were transferred from the special revenue fund. However, the monies that were transferred were allotted to the agencies that contribute to that special revenue fund. So there was a portion that was assessed to each agency, and that was an
Dr. King,
function.
That is a decision that the boards have made about how to manage the transfer, but there could have been other ways, other decisions made about how to manage the transfer.
Madam Chair, you are correct, yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Let's move on then.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Zacherpate, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work. It's the first time that I'm testifying before this committee, and thank you for the opportunity. As you are likely aware, the Board of Social Work regulates approximately 10,500 licensees in the state, and in planning this biennial budget, the board gave very careful consideration to all of our budget initiatives, and the one initiative in particular that I come before you this morning is to ask your support in the change item that the board submitted to essentially maintain our current licensing fee amounts with an additional 10% reduction. And the reason to ask for this reduction is that we had a temporary fee reduction that went into effect the beginning of 2006, was passed in the 2005 session. And even with that fee reduction, because we've had a slight increase in licensees and applicants, and we've also continued to reduce expenditures, we are still over-collecting. And so the board is asking your support to approve this fee reduction, essentially to maintain fees and reduce them an additional 10% to better align our revenues and expenditures.
Any questions? If not, thank you very much. Let's move on.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Julie with the Administrative Services Unit again, and I'm here on behalf of the Board of Dietetic and Nutrition Practice. Lori Nicholson, their executive director, is unable to attend today. On page 6, there is one change in hers, and that is a fee reduction. Really, during the 2005 legislative session, she reduced her fees, and it was to end or sunset on June 30th of 2009. And we're requesting that that current reduced fee continue based on the dollars that she brings in and the expenses. It makes sense just to continue with the reduced rate that was the sunset on June 30th of 2009.
And this would be continuing then without a sunset?
Correct.
Any questions on this page? All right, thank you. Let's move on.
Good Morning.
Welcome.
Welcome. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability, acronym otherwise known as MSCOD. And I've gotten a few handouts here for you. Briefly, our current budget is at $1,048,000, and the governor's recommended proposal is $996,000 for fiscal years 2010 and 2011. You've got the handout before you. Currently, you know, we've got 7.1 staff looking. Actually, with the grants that we participate in, they pay for 2.2 of those staff, and 15-member governor-appointed councils as well, council members. And in terms of looking at what the budget proposal will, how it affect us, we will have fewer town hall meetings, fewer trainings regarding on the ADA and emergency preparedness that we do work with the Department of Homeland Security and the new MMB agency as well. There'll be less projects and printing of some of our collateral materials as we move forward. Reduction of council meetings. Currently, we have close to 4 a year, and we'll be looking at only doing 2 to 3, but also looking at some new electronic means of holding meetings to make up for some of those we are not able to. Less out-state travel and out-of-state travel as well. And then we'll continue to look at grant opportunities, but that does pose kind of a double-edged sword for us in terms of sometimes it requires us to have more administrative support when we look at bringing in grant activities. So working with our new small agency resource team, we're hoping that that will help us as we move forward to be able to handle the administrative costs when we're looking at bringing in different grant opportunities.
And members, this is a reduction of general fund money. This is not special revenue.
Right.
And it's a 5% reduction. Are there any questions? Thank you very
Thank you.
Much. Next, we have Roberta Olpheim.
Is that you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roberta Olpheim. I'm the head of the Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I will just quickly go through. There's a handout that I won't go through all the items in it. I will tell you from the budget perspective, first of all, we've been operating within the base budget for over 5-plus bienniums with no expanse of the base to meet the unmet needs. We're currently down from the high of 20.5 FTEs. We used to have 8 regional offices. We now have 6 regional offices. The only change item in our budget is the governor's proposed 5% budget reduction. With that, our strategies, we will be eliminating one management position. There's a student worker position that, depending upon how the rest of the budget falls out, we won't be able to replace when the current student leaves. We'll be reallocating staff, some from the medical review, back into client services. We've been able to reduce a small portion of our rental space, and we will look at reducing and minimizing travel expenses with less face-to-face meetings and more telephone, fax, email. Our ability to serve citizens is maxed out at this point. As budgets shrink and inflation continues to be a factor, we'll continue to reduce the capacity and the number of cases that we can handle. With that, I would stand for any questions.
Any questions? This is a general fund reduction of 5%. Thank you very much. Next, Ombudsman for Families.
Good morning, Senators and members of the committee. My name is Ann Hill, and I'm with the Office of Ombudspersons for Families, and I just would like to acknowledge that my 3 other colleagues are here also today, and that's Muriel Gubasta, Don Blanchard, and Bao Ning Chu. Our testimony here today to you is also in response to the 5% reduction. As you can see, we're our small agency. The majority of the general fund, in fact, all of the general fund appropriation goes towards the 4 ombudsman's salaries. And there was a mistake in the budget that you received. That it stated in the background that The reduction would not impact the FTEs, but it actually does. We are losing our one administrative staff as a result of this reduction. As a way to counteract that loss, we are looking into some other options, contracting with contracting for administrative services, using services of other ombudsman offices. So that's how we're looking to address the issue. Are you having any questions?
Thank you. The Veterans Affairs Department for the Veterans Homes.
Madam Chair, my name is Christine Keel, Department of Veterans Affairs. We'll go right to the budget pages. The first change item, which is on pages 10 and 11 of your budget pages, is our information technology request. While this will not be coming out of this side of the budget, it is something that will affect the home, so we just wanted to draw it to your attention. We'll be seeking funding for this in Senator Vickerman's committee. The next change item is on page 9 of your budget pages. It's for the Hastings Mental Health Program. This request will add one mental health professional and one psychiatric nurse out at the Hastings home. Right now, Hastings borrows from Minneapolis, and given the incident of this summer, the governor's office and the department felt it imperative to put some full-time psychiatric staff on the Hastings campus. That is a $220,000 increase in each year of the biennium for that change item. The next change item is...
Can you just tell me in terms of the Hastings facility, how many beds there are there, and of the beds, how many are occupied by people diagnosed with mental illness?
Madam Chair, there are 200 domiciliary beds at the Hastings facility. I do not have that answer of how many are diagnosed with mental illness, but we will get that answer to you.
Thank you. Let's move on then.
Okay. The next change item in front of this committee is on page 8 of your budget books, and it's the repairs and betterment request. This request you've seen in front of your committee before. It is the repair of interior building deficiencies, provide updates for life and safety compliances, replacement of ongoing wear and tear items, and routine mechanical repairs. We are asking for $2.5 million in for the biennium.
And this usually is handled by the bonding committee?
Madam Chair, usually asset preservation is. The repair and betterments are not. They are usually a general fund appropriation.
Okay, let's go on.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, the last change item for the homes is the maintaining the current service levels. That's page 7 of your budget books. This recommendation will help cover the increased cost of nursing care compensation, fuel, utilities, pharmaceuticals, and foods for all of the homes.
I thought the governor was recommending that there be a salary freeze.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kramschroeder and I are understanding that these salary increases are negotiated by the unions, not as state employees, because it's the nurses' unions and the like.
Okay, well, we noticed that there is no increase in the budgets for the other nursing homes in the state. There's decreases in the governor's budget in those areas. We also will call to your attention that we just had a legislative auditor's report that showed that there was a substantial amount of overtime in your base budget that was questionable at best.
Madam Chair, we are aware of the overtime issue that has plagued the homes in the past. Deputy Commissioner Acevedo has taken a very aggressive approach to curbing that, and will continue.
Right, so those reductions are not showing up on this budget page, is my point.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, we finished Thank you very much for your attendance this morning. I know Mondays this early are not always so easy. With that, our meeting is adjourned.